This is Crafting the Short Story with your host, author and editor, Darren Todd of DarrenTodd.net. Now, let's explore the agony and the ecstasy, the magic and the mechanics of short fiction.
Hello and welcome to episode 12, Life Cycle of a Short Story, Part 2. Last week, in terms of life cycle, we talked about how long between the first draft and the final draft, how long does it take to get fresh eyes, how many rejections should you accumulate before you revise a work, and talked a little about simultaneous submissions or subsequent submissions of a work still being considered. But this week, we're going to talk a little bit more about going back to the well. That is, how many times can you use a short story, publish it in different venues as well as different media or different derivatives of the same story, and what is a natural progression for that? So foremost, I hope that whoever's listening to this has been fortunate enough to get a short story published. But if not, I'm sure, first of all, that day will come, but also what is to consider are the contracts and the various kinds of rights that you'll be selling. The important thing to note is that you are indeed, unless otherwise stated, licensing your work. They cannot use the work in perpetuity. They are simply licensing the rights to print the work or to create some sort of production of it, etc. We'll get into all of that. Now, this has changed a little bit since the advent of the internet. Well, I say a little bit. Actually, the consequences are quite large and something to consider. But used to be, let's say pre-internet, would be you were selling the first North American serial rights, assuming you're in North America. And there are different rights for, you know, whatever it is, or Britain or Europe or whatever. And that would be essentially implying that this is the first time that this work has been printed. So it's not just allowing them to print it. It is saying this has not been printed, published before. And actually, you can sell first rights to multiple places. So you can do first North American serial rights, and then you can do first European rights, etc. So that's one way of considering what I'll call going back to the well and making use of a single story multiple times, is that there are plenty of publications that would take a work that was printed in North America but not printed in Europe, etc., vice versa. And then the second is what's called one-time rights, and that is they're simply purchasing or for contributor copies or in some way exchanging the ability to print it one time, and that means it could be something that was previously printed or not. You do, of course, have to let them know, and you would do so in the query letter itself. Let them know if the work has ever been published before and where. And those are the big two in terms of dead tree printing. There are others, but I'm not going to get into those specifically right now. And I would say for the contracts that I've seen, and this can certainly vary, but usually there is at least a term of about a year where they have some sort of rights built in to where, let's say, it is, you know, they have the ability to use it within that year. If it's a quarterly mag and it goes not in this issue, but in a subsequent issue, etc. But usually about a year is what you're looking at, where it, for that year, unless you're talking about derivative rights, taking something print and turning it into something video, turning it into something audio. And I've seen as much as 5 years, actually, but this that was actually for anthology rights for a piece that I had to go into a royalty share deal for an anthology. And even that was for print. Again, so 5 years, there's nothing I can do to sell one-time rights, 21. I can still look at derivative rights, such as audio. And for that story, I may well indeed do exactly that. As we'll get to later, there are some great things happening in terms of those derivative rights, for audio in particular. But the internet has thrown a monkey wrench in two different ways, or shall I say two different monkey wrenches into this process. So the first is that if it's put on the internet and it's available everywhere and can be taken in by anyone ostensibly speaking that language, then you're probably not going to have as much luck, if any, selling it to another English-speaking market. That is, if you've sold first North American serial rights, and yet that was for an online publication that is available worldwide, you may not have any luck selling first European rights, for instance. Because it's like, well, anybody can get to that site, whether the second one is print or not. And the second is that sometimes the work doesn't go away. It is a double-edged sword, because on one hand, I think people expect it to a degree, is that if I've published something and I sold it to a website, then I'm expecting, you know, as a part of their what's called first electronic rights, that it's probably going to stay up in perpetuity. Now, this is technically called archival rights, but I'll be honest, I don't think that I've even come across it worded that way, let alone spelled out very specifically in a contract. Most of the time, it would be simply written in an email saying, you know, a part of this is that we're going to keep it up. So what is the problem with this? So first of all, much, much harder to go back to the well for print rights. You technically can, so long as you are outside of the contractual period for the initial first electronic rights contract, sell the one-time rights. But you would still have to divulge that, okay, yes, I'm trying to sell you one-time rights for your print mag or another online mag, but I have to tell you that on this website, it's still up and probably will be for the life of the website. That makes your work much less enticing. So some good advice I've seen actually suggests beginning with print, specific to North America, if you're in North America, obviously, and then branching out from there, which makes perfect sense. So you're trying first rights North America, then try first rights in other publications in other markets, Europe, Australia, UK, etc. Then worry about one-time rights. That is just, and you could do one-time print rights, you know, for as many publications as you want. It's probably a little less enticing knowing it's not the first time it's been printed, but it also implies some chops and, you know, that some other editor out there thought, yes, this is good enough to print. So I suppose that too is good and bad. And then sort of moving down the line, again, these are not, I'm not talking about all the rights. There are, you know, reprint rights and again, talking about the anthology or something like that, those sorts of rights, but essentially just moving down to where the absolute last thing are your electronic archival rights being surrendered. That is to say, this work's life is over. Or, and I do think this is definitely another way of looking at it, that if we're talking about first electronic rights and technically archival rights, and it's going to remain on the internet forever, there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion, if you're talking about a short piece that you've not poured your soul into. Flash fiction, for instance. I have probably 3 pieces of flash fiction that at any time I could pull up on the internet that are still on there, sometimes from years ago. And this is sometimes a feather in my cap. If I'm talking about, you know, my website, or if someone says, well, I'd love to read something of yours. Yeah, just, you know, Google my name and this, or go to this website and I'm one of the authors, or something like that. So literally for an archive, it could come in handy, especially, I mean, if you're talking about some people who have dozens and dozens, specifically of flash fiction. Why not? I'm not suggesting that just because a piece is flash means that it's worth less to the author, sure. But let's face it, it probably is worth less to the publication. So that means its lifespan is probably going to be shorter. And ostensibly, it took not as long. I mean, why would it take as long to write with a few exceptions? Again, I'm not trying to put down flash fiction here. I'm simply talking about the way that it is currently working and operating in the modern market. So that's something to consider, is that if you are going directly to first electronic rights, or even one step further with archival rights, then just make sure it's a work that you don't intend to sell multiple times over. Now, all of this, with few exceptions that would have to be spelled out in the contract, still allows for derivative rights, and that is specifically video or audio. And I would say in audio, you're definitely seeing a resurgence of radio-style dramas and things like that in podcasts. And this is a great second life for your work. Most of the places I've seen don't require the author to narrate. And to be honest, the ones that do require the author to narrate, I can see why they're doing it, because it's, you know, division of labor. They may not have very many people working for them. They don't have a large volunteer staff or something, but they're pretty much inferior to the ones where you have people who are either, usually it's a staff of volunteers, but skilled voice actors and skilled audio producers who are overlaying excellent and applicable musical scores and sound effects and just doing some amazing things right now with radio drama style works. Most of these places I've seen, however, don't pay, but there is obviously and always with short fiction a prestige factor. And the prestige factor, I would argue, is certainly much higher for a work that has seen multiple venues. First, North American serial rights, followed by being sold somewhere else for one-time rights, and maybe anthologized somewhere online, and also done as an audible podcast. I mean, that's a great life for a short story. Now, I will say that specifically for online publications, there have been times, and these times are specific to flash fiction in my case, where there was no real contract. So that's something to just be aware of, is you may learn these rights, and this podcast is by no means inclusive of what you need to know about your rights, but it's at least a start. And you may know your rights, and the editor might even know them, but mostly, especially for something that is not paying, it will be sort of like, yeah, that sounds neat, we'll take it, and it'll be available next month here. And they may or may not even say that they're going to archive it. There was one that accepted it, and then I found out that they didn't archive it, so it didn't pay, and I was all right sending it to them and without the story going somewhere else. And then I come to find out, no, it's not archived, so while I'm glad it got published or on that site, there's also no way for me to prove it either, because it's not archived. It can't be referenced. But now, of course, I can send it somewhere else and just say that, yes, indeed, the first electronic rights were bought, even if it was for free, essentially, and then try to market one-time rights to it. But let's be honest. You could probably get away with violating almost any of these rules I've just talked about. But the issue is that if something does go south, and the community among editors is probably smaller than you think it is, and you end up getting egg on an editor's face, that's a stain on your name you really don't want. The good news is that short fiction doesn't make a lot of money. So the rights and the rules are often not strictly enforced or not as hard as stone. A contract is binding, sure, but you might be surprised at the flexibility. Because, we're not talking about a lot of money here. But another thing to consider is that while you're putting your story through a natural life cycle, which I hope, listening to this podcast, it's a little more intuitive as to what that cycle should be, that you also consider that maybe down the road you want to publish a collection of short stories. And if that's the case, I would suggest avoiding selling your electronic archival rights. Because I can't imagine being a publishing house and wanting in my collection of short stories and the thing I'm about to publish, wanting stories that someone could just go to a website and access. Now, as a consumer, this might seem just fine. That is, people all the time buy a collection or a dead tree version or something that is simply collected of things that are individually available online. There are all sorts of examples of this, but that's thinking logically. That's thinking, yeah, I don't think behavioral economics-wise this will make a whole lot of difference in whether the consumers buy this book of 20 short stories when two of them are available on an archived digital website. But it's probably more the rights that the publisher's worried about rather than whether this is going to affect the market. And, you know, a big part of that, of course, is that any editor is just dying to reject you. I mean, they get so many manuscripts and so many ideas, and short story collections are, of course, no moneymaker anyway, is that it's probably more or just as much a case of looking for a reason to reject you. Well, that was part two of Life Cycle of a Short Story. I hope that gave some insight into rights and to different paths that a single story can take from the beginning to the end of its market viability. So tune in next week, hop on iTunes and rate Crafting the Short Story, or write a review. I would certainly appreciate that as well. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
This has been Crafting the Short Story with Darren Todd. Visit Darren online at darrentodd.net.